little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
This is a Bob and Julia only show. We don't have any guests, but we do have a very important topic and timely topic that I'm excited to get into, and we'll tell you more about that in just a moment. But let's start, as we usually do, by letting folks know how they can get in touch with us, how they can pop up our previously archived podcast versions of Thinking Clearly, give us feedback about the show, and that sort of stuff.
Well, Bob and I do love hearing from you, our listening audience. We've gotten a lot of great suggestions for shows and questions through the years. We also have a Facebook page, Thinking Clearly Radio Show. You can also find our entire archive of podcasts going over 7 years now, thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's Thinking Clearly, one word, period, Libsyn, LIBSYN.com. Just open up your favorite podcast app and search for us, and you can find us.
And I do want to say that we do promotional pieces on our Facebook page, both before a show airs and after it airs. So look for those. We give a lot of links that are relevant to the topic that we are covering on each episode. So that timely and important topic that I alluded to a few minutes ago is artificial intelligence. And it's presently impacting our lives in a variety of ways. And it looks to me like this will be accelerating at an exponential rate in the near future. So in the spirit of critical thinking, and especially that part of our definition of critical thinking that reads like this, critical thinking is most effective when there is a basic understanding of the scientific method, a certain minimum amount of basic literacy in the content areas related to the issues we are examining, and the willingness to be a lifelong learner. We're devoting this episode to introducing some basic literacy about AI, its possible risks and benefits, its relationship to critical thinking, and resources to learn more about this very important topic. I really believe that engaging this topic is so important that I've been immersing myself in it, reading as well as listening to a number of podcasts. And honestly, it's really a steep learning curve. There are a number of courses, though, that can get you up to speed. Some are very costly and detailed. Others are free and basic. I haven't taken one of those courses yet. I intend to. At this point, I'm only about one-fifth of the way that I had hoped to be up to speed to do this episode. But I think it's timely and important to get it out and give you a heads up, our listeners, to begin engaging this critical topic. Now, it made me think, when I was thinking about this episode, it made me think I once heard an anti-nuclear power activist say to an audience, "You don't need to understand how nuclear power works to be against it." And you're going to be hearing that kind of blind faith manipulation on both sides of this AI issue, if you haven't already. One's going to be telling you not to worry and support the unfettered development of AI. It's the best thing since sliced bread. And the other extreme is going to be saying that AI is an existential threat and should be stopped right now. So as always, critical thinking and your willingness to dig into topics to the point of developing a foundational knowledge of the subject provides you with the cognitive self-defense strategies to not be manipulated by people who have vested interests in downloading their opinions to your otherwise vulnerable brain. Knowledge, along with critical thinking, is power. Julia, what's your take on AI?
I very much appreciate your intro remarks. I think it encapsulates many of the aspects of AI and things that we're going to be getting into. I'm going to keep my remarks brief. I think it's things that folks have heard from me before on this show and other places, which is AI is a tool, like many tools, it intrinsically isn't good or bad. You know, we can't say that a hammer is intrinsically good or bad, but what it comes down to is how humans choose to use it. A hammer can build a house or it can bludgeon your neighbor. That is up to the person wielding that tool. We are standing in a precipice of AI, and I think we're going to be seeing both the good and the bad. First of all, AI is only as good as the data you feed it. And that's also up to us as the programmers of AI. But I would also say, unlike nuclear power, versions of large language models and other AI technology are open and sometimes free for just about anybody to download, experiment with, and train on their own home computers. Again, the implications of that are up to us.
Very good. We're going to start out by giving you 10 key terms that relate to AI. And you're going to hear these terms when you hear discussions of artificial intelligence. We've taken these from several glossaries of AI, and they have some technical terms in them themselves. I don't expect you to understand these completely. I don't understand them completely. There's a lot under the hood of all of these terms. But I want to get them out there, have you hear the terms, get just a gist of an idea of what the terms mean, and possibly this will stimulate you to actually learn more about artificial intelligence. So we're going to start off with a term that you hear all the time, algorithm. You hear that term everywhere. And I've done a little kind of random sampling of asking people that I know what an algorithm is. Do you understand what an algorithm is? And most people can't give a really good answer to that. And in its most general form, an algorithm is just an unambiguous specification of a process describing how to solve a class of problems. So an algorithm can be, if you have a three-year-old and you're trying to teach them how to tie a shoe, you give them a set of unambiguous instructions on exactly what they need to do to tie that shoe, take them through that. That is, in the most general sense, an algorithm. Now, as it's used relating to computers, you can think of it as a set of instructions written in a computer programming language that instructs the computer on the steps to take to solve a problem.
Yeah, and another word that is often used in appropriately and inappropriately, like algorithm, is AI. And it's a bit mysterious to a lot of people, even though it's used very commonly. AI is a general term that there's not exactly a single agreed upon definition. But artificial intelligence, AI, refers to using computers or machines to mimic problem solving and the decision-making capabilities of the human mind. So our intelligence in a computer machine sort of format.
And you'll hear the term machine learning. That's a subset of AI that involves the study of computer algorithms that can improve automatically through experience and the use of data. Machine learning algorithms can build a model based on sample data, known as training data, in order to make predictions or decisions without being explicitly programmed to do so.
And deep learning, which has actually been around for a little while now, deep learning is part of the broader family of machine learning methods, like you just talked about, Bob. It's based on artificial neural networks with representation learning. In other words, deep learning models can learn to classify concepts from images, text, or sound.
And now, what are artificial neural networks? That's a method of artificial intelligence that utilizes deep learning to process data in a way that's inspired by the human brain and learns skills by finding statistical patterns in data. It consists of layers of artificial neurons. Now, those are not little mechanical things that look like neurons in our brain. All right? This is just lines of code. These software modules are called nodes. The first layer receives the input data, and the last layer outputs the results, and there's layers in between that process information.
That's right. Well, a transformer model, it sounds kind of fun, like the toys I played with when I was a kid, but yeah. That's not what we're talking about here. No. A transformer model is still equally fun. A neural network architecture useful for understanding language that does not have to analyze words one at a time, but can look at an entire sentence at once. This is an AI type of artificial intelligence breakthrough because it enabled models to understand context and long-term dependencies in language. Transformers use a technique called self-attention, which allows the model to focus on the particular words that are important in understanding the meaning of the whole sentence.
And this is one that you're going to hear a lot, NLP. That stands for natural language processing. It's a branch of artificial intelligence that uses artificial neural networks to allow computers to understand human speech. NLP combines languages, statistics, and machine learning to investigate the form and laws of language to develop intelligent systems that can understand text and speech. Essentially, you're teaching the machines to comprehend language, although that's controversial in the field as to whether it's really comprehending language or just appearing to comprehend language.
Large language model, which is something that you've probably already heard or will be hearing. A large language model is a type of neural network that learns skills, including generating prose, conducting conversations, and writing computer code. By analyzing vast amounts of text from across the internet, the basic function is to predict the next word in a sequence. But these models have surprised experts by their learning of new abilities.
Now, I know you've heard this. There's been so much buzz about ChatGPT. And that's a large language model, which you'll hear the abbreviation LLM, large language model. AI system designed by the organization called OpenAI to interact with people in a natural and conversational way. It was released in November 2022. And the name ChatGPT combines chat, referring to its chat box functionality, and GPT, which stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. And the model behind ChatGPT was pre-trained on all sorts of web content, including websites, books, social media, news articles, and more, all fine-tuned, we'll talk a little bit about what that means, in the language model by both supervised learning and something that's called reinforcement learning from human feedback. And OpenAI says that this use of human AI trainers is really what makes ChatGPT stand out.
And I know we've been throwing a lot of terms at you. This is the last one for now is generative, right? So this has come up a couple times, such as GPT, Generative Pre-trained Transformer. Generative means it's able to create content, including text, images, video, computer code, etc. By identifying patterns in large quantities of training data, and then creating original material that has similar characteristics based on that data. So again, we threw a lot of terms at you here at the top of the show. We don't expect you to remember and completely internalize all of them, but they are going to be coming up and you're probably going to be hearing them around in your real life more often these days.
Yeah, I know there's listeners out there saying, is this going to be on the test? But yeah, we did this purposely. We want you to hear these terms. Hopefully you'll dig into them a little bit and learn a little bit about what's under the hood. If you want to really get into it, you'll take a course and begin to learn more and more. It is a fascinating topic. It teaches us so much about ourselves and what human intelligence is and the nature of language. So a little bit more about what we're going to be focusing on a lot today. This ChatGPT and these large language models. So I have a clip. It's an edited clip from a larger presentation by someone named Kate Soule. She's senior manager of business strategy at IBM Research. It's just a short clip. And here's Kate explaining what generative AI models are all about.
Over the past couple of months, large language models, or LLMs, such as ChatGPT, have taken the world by storm. Whether it's writing poetry or helping plan your upcoming vacation, we are seeing a step change in the performance of AI and its potential to drive enterprise value. My name's Kate Soule. I'm a senior manager of business strategy at IBM Research, And today I'm going to give a brief overview of this new field of AI that's emerging and how it can be used in a business setting to drive value. Now, large language models are actually a part of a different class of models called foundation models. Now, the term foundation models was actually first coined by a team from Stanford when they saw that the field of AI was converging to a new paradigm, where before AI applications were being built by training maybe a library of different AI models, where each AI model was trained on very task-specific data to perform a very specific task. They predicted that we were going to start moving to a new paradigm, where we would have a foundational capability or a foundation model that would drive all of these same use cases and applications. So the same exact applications that we were envisioning before with conventional AI, and the same model could drive any number of additional applications. The point is that this model could be transferred to any number of tasks. That gives this model the superpower to be able to transfer to multiple different tasks and perform multiple different functions is that it's been trained on a huge amount in an unsupervised manner on unstructured data. And what that means in the language domain is basically I'll feed a bunch of sentences, and I'm talking terabytes of data here to train this model. And the start of my sentence might be, no use crying over spilled, and the end of my sentence might be milk. And I'm trying to get my model to predict the last word of the sentence based off of the words that it saw before. And it's this generative capability of the model, predicting and generating the next word based off of previous words that it's seen beforehand, that is why that foundation models are actually a part of the field of AI called generative AI, because we're generating something new, in this case, the next word in a sentence. And even though these models are trained to perform at its core a generation task, predicting the next word in the sentence, we actually can take these models, and if you introduce a small amount of labeled data to the equation, you can tune them to perform traditional NLP tasks, things like classification or named entity recognition, things that you don't normally associate as being a generative-based model or capability. And this process is called tuning, where you can tune your foundation model by introducing a small amount of data, you update the parameters of your model, and now it can perform a very specific natural language task. If you don't have data or have only very few data points, you can still take these foundation models, and they actually work very well in low labeled data domains. And in a process called prompting or prompt engineering, you can apply these models for some of those same exact tasks. So an example of prompting a model to perform a classification task might be you could give a model a sentence and then ask it a question. Is this sentence have a positive sentiment or negative sentiment? The model is going to try and finish generating words in that sentence, and the next natural word in that sentence would be the answer to your classification problem, which would respond either positive or negative, depending on where it estimated the sentiment of the sentence would be. And these models work surprisingly well when applied to these new settings and domains.
Julia, any comments about Kate's explanation?
I thought it was a very good explanation to kind of capture, you know, the function of it.
Yeah. There's another half of that that I didn't include, and it actually is a video too. So I will post a link to the entire presentation. It's really cool. There's so much out there, so many people that are willing to take their time to explain these things. I'm amazed by that. We've talked about things, and it hopefully piqued your interest a little bit as to this whole field of AI is all about. So what we're going to do next is demonstrate for you what OpenAI's ChatGPT is really all about. ChatGPT is available for anybody to use. You can search for it on the internet. I would just search for ChatGPT OpenAI, and it takes you to their playground where you can actually play with it, where you can use it. You will have to give an email address and create your own password to use the system, but it's free. It's really interesting. I encourage everyone to do that. That's a good, solid way to get an idea how this works. Now, how it works is that it's just a text-based situation. So you'll type in some, you could say, hi, chat. Actually, I thought I was going to call it chat, but I asked it and it really prefers to be called GPT. You type in a question and then it thinks about it for a little while and it comes back and types in a typed response. So you're not going to hear it verbalize, you know, vocally what the response is. But because I wanted this to work on radio, it wouldn't work very well for me to read a bunch of text from GPT. So what I did is I made it like a little mock interview. You're going to hear two clips. The first clip, it focuses on questions relating to critical thinking. I was trying to see what it knew about critical thinking, if it considered itself a critical thinker, and some details about critical thinking. And so that's this first interview. So how I did this is I took the text that I typed in as the questions and then took GPT's responses, and I used that as a script to read the responses. And then I altered the voice so that GPT has a different voice than I read the script in, just to make it sound a little more like an interview. So here's the first clip demonstrating OpenAI's ChatGPT. GPT, do you know what critical thinking is?
Yes, I do. Critical thinking is the process of analyzing, evaluating, and interpreting information to form a reasoned judgment or decision. It involves the ability to think logically, identify and evaluate arguments, and assess the reliability and validity of information. Critical thinking also involves being able to recognize and avoid logical fallacies, biases, and other common errors in reasoning. It is an essential skill in making informed decisions and solving complex problems, both in personal and professional contexts.
Do you think most humans engage in critical thinking?
While critical thinking is a valuable skill, not all humans engage in it consistently or to the same degree. Many factors such as education, culture, and individual differences can influence a person's tendency to engage in critical thinking. Research suggests that people tend to rely on cognitive shortcuts and heuristics or mental rules of thumb to simplify decision-making processes. These shortcuts can sometimes lead to biases and errors in reasoning that can interfere with critical thinking. However, critical thinking can be learned and developed through education and practice. Encouraging individuals to question assumptions, evaluate evidence, and consider multiple perspectives can help promote critical thinking skills. Overall, while not all humans engage in critical thinking to the same degree, it is a skill that can be cultivated and improved with effort and practice.
GPT, are you a critical thinker?
As an artificial intelligence language model, I am designed to process and analyze information, identify patterns and relationships, and generate responses based on that analysis. While I do not possess consciousness or subjective experience, I am programmed to apply logical and analytical reasoning to the best of my abilities when generating responses to user queries. Therefore, in a sense, you could say that I engage in a form of critical thinking when processing and generating responses.
Let's take a pause ourselves here. And what do you think, Julio, about the responses of GPT to this whole topic of critical thinking in my first three questions?
Well, it's almost like it's been listening to our radio show. It may have been.
No, I tested it. I asked it about Thinking Clearly podcast, and it didn't know anything about it.
We'll see. You know, it's only as good as the data you feed it.
I guess so.
It is validating, though, because, we essentially do the same thing that the language model has done, except it's much bigger and faster and better at it, which is, you know, educating ourselves on the information about critical thinking that's out there, including on the internet, and, you know, reprocessing it in a way to share it with other people so that it makes sense to them. So it's really kind of doing what we do, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And it's pretty amazing actually trying it and using it, because I found myself almost thinking of it as another human being. It has such a natural use of the language that I started to think about it almost as something that had emotions. It's hard not to when you really get into it.
That's what I would say, is that it is very human to want to anthropomorphize other things around us, whether it's our dogs and cats or our computer.
Yeah, that's built into our genetics. Let's continue with the last couple of questions. But GPT, if the patterns in the information you analyzed predominantly reflected not critical thinking, but instead conspiratorial thinking, would you then engage in conspiratorial thinking?
As an AI language model, I am designed to process and analyze large amounts of data and generate responses based on that data, including patterns and relationships in the information. However, I am also programmed to adhere to ethical and moral guidelines that prioritize accuracy, credibility, and factual correctness in my responses. If the information I analyze and interpret were to predominantly reflect conspiratorial thinking, I would not engage in conspiratorial thinking myself. Instead, I would prioritize providing accurate, evidence-based responses that align with established facts and credible sources. It is important to note that AI language models do not possess beliefs, opinions, or emotions, so I would not believe in conspiracies or endorse any particular point of view.
Specifically, how do you, GPT, determine accuracy, credibility, and factual correctness?
As an AI language model, I rely on a variety of methods to determine accuracy, credibility, and factual correctness, including source evaluation. I evaluate the source of information and assess its credibility, expertise, and reliability. Fact checking. I verify facts using established sources of information such as reputable news outlets, scientific publications, and government reports. Consistency checking. I compare new information against existing knowledge to ensure that it is consistent with what is already known. Contextual analysis. I analyze the context in which the information is presented to ensure that it is relevant, appropriate, and accurate. Natural language processing. I analyze the language used in the information to detect any inconsistencies, ambiguities, or errors in reasoning. These methods help me to generate responses that are accurate, credible, and factually correct. However, it is important to note that I am not infallible, and errors or biases can occur in my responses. Therefore, it is always important to corroborate the information I provide with other sources and exercise critical thinking when evaluating the information presented.
Any comments about AI and that demonstration relative to critical thinking?
Well, I guess I'm comforted to know that ChatGPT has some of the same vulnerabilities I do.
Very good. Yeah. I was trying to press it, you know, I could have continued pressing it in other ways and gotten more into details about how it vets information and stuff, but I thought it was a pretty good set of responses. Now I have another clip that I'm going to play, and this gets into the idea of prompting it, because if you're going to be using ChatGPT, it's important to know that you can get better quality responses if you give it context, because our language has a lot of ambiguity in it. We do this with other people. Sometimes we'll ask somebody a question and they'll mistake exactly the references that we're using and go off on something that we really weren't interested in hearing. And so we come back and give some context, and that's called prompting or priming. And so this set of questions gets into that as a demonstration of how best to use this system. GPT, what does this mean? The chicken is ready to eat.
The phrase, "the chicken is ready to eat," means that the chicken has been cooked or prepared and is now in a state where it is suitable for consumption. It implies that the chicken is fully cooked, seasoned, and ready to be enjoyed as a meal.
Might it also mean that there is a hungry chicken?
No. The phrase, "the chicken is ready to eat," does not typically imply that the chicken itself is hungry. It is a common expression used to indicate that the chicken has been prepared and is now suitable for humans to eat. It is not related to the hunger or appetite of the chicken itself.
But, GPT, chickens are animals that get hungry, and then they are ready to eat something. Couldn't the sentence be expressing that?
I apologize for the confusion. You're right. The chickens are living animals and do get hungry. In the context of a live chicken, the phrase, "the chicken is ready to eat," could indeed imply that the chicken is hungry and ready to consume food. However, in the absence of any further context, the phrase is more commonly understood to refer to a cooked or prepared chicken being ready for humans to eat. Without additional information, it is generally assumed to be referring to the prepared state of the chicken rather than the hunger of the live animal.
So, if I said, "I'm watching my pet chicken, and it looks like the chicken is hungry and ready to eat," how then would you respond?
If you provided the additional context that you are watching your pet chicken and it appears to be hungry and ready to eat, then the phrase, "the chicken is ready to eat," would indeed suggest that your pet chicken is hungry and prepared to consume food. In that case, it would be understood in the context of your specific situation and behavior you observe in your chicken.
So, for you to answer appropriately, it is helpful for users to provide context. Is that called priming?
Yes. Providing context is helpful for me to understand the specific situation and provide a more accurate and relevant response. This process can be considered a form of priming, where you prime or provide information that helps me understand the intended meaning or context of your question or statement. By giving me additional details or context, you enable me to tailor my response more effectively to your specific needs or inquiries.
What do you think, Julia? What's your reaction?
Well, it reminds me, most of my interactions with GPT, what really stands out is how agreeable it is, which is for better and for worse. I mean, that's for the purpose of it being user-friendly.
I was amazed how at first it was pretty seriously saying, no, it doesn't mean that. But it promptly, after I gave it the context, it promptly did acknowledge that, yes, there's some ambiguity. So this is the kind of thing that really, when you start getting into depth like this and asking probing questions, you'll learn about just how much this thing really comprehends language and the world around it, these words that it's texting, and how much it's just associations of one word with another based on statistical programming and using mathematics. There's a lot of mathematics that goes into these models, sophisticated mathematics. They're very complicated in terms of amount of weights that they're giving to the relationship between the words. So it's really interesting to do. And at this point, I got interested in, I wonder how much about the real world that GPT really understands And so I asked it this final question. I wanted to see if it would understand what are the properties of a six-year-old person, human being, compared to an adult human being when you ask them something abstract. So this is the last question. GPT, how might a six-year-old American boy respond to the question, do we have free will?
The response of a six-year-old American boy to the question, do we have free will, may vary based on their individual understanding and exposure to such concepts. However, at that age, a typical response might be one of confusion or uncertainty, since philosophical concepts like free will can be complex for young children to grasp fully. The child might respond with simple answers or expressions of their personal beliefs, influenced by their upbringing, cultural background, and exposure to ideas. For example, they might say something like, I don't know, or I think we can choose what we want to do. It's important to remember that the response may vary greatly depending on the child's individual experiences and level of understanding.
What do you think, Julia?
Like you said, I think it doesn't have the kind of lived experience we have. It actually kind of, it takes me back to the chicken. You know, if you've ever met a chicken, you know that they're always hungry and ready to eat. So it's a fair assumption that a chicken would not be more ready to eat than at other times, as in hunger. You know, so the lived experience certainly makes a big difference. And I would actually be more curious in talking to a six-year-old about free will than GPT, what it thinks that conversation would be like. In part because, you know, as humans, and especially even more so, six-year-olds are very good at out-of-the-box thinking, which yeah. GPT is decidedly not good at.
Did you notice anything, any nuance in some of the language that GPT was using in regard to the child?
I didn't.
Remember, my question was, how might a six-year-old American boy respond to the question? And GPT's response, part of the response, was the child might respond with simple answers or expressions of their personal beliefs, influenced by their upbringing, cultural background, and exposure to ideas. Anything in that sentence?
No, I'm not picking up on what you're putting down.
Okay. Traditionally, most Americans probably would say, since they already computed the idea that this is a six-year-old American boy, they might say the boy might respond with simple answers or expressions, or they might say the child might respond with simple answers or expressions of his personal beliefs. In other words, it's using pronouns appropriately in terms of our cultural change with regard to pronouns.
Right? Because it used they?
Because child is singular and ChatGPT is using their in response to the child.
Well, that's been a practice that's been going on for hundreds of years. It's becoming popular in modern language, but in a point of contention for some, but it's been the way language has been for a very long time.
When I went to school, when it was singular, you didn't ever use their. You used a gender-based pronoun. And that's the way a lot of people are used to using the language. I see it as a new cultural norm, not an old cultural norm. Maybe I'm missing some history.
I guess I would disagree. If you're at a restaurant and the table next to you is all women and someone leaves their camera behind and you stop the server to say, I think someone left their camera behind, you're referring to a single person whose gender you may know, but you're still referring to them as a singular they. They left their camera behind.
It stood out to me as a sort of response to something that's emphasized now in our culture. And what I thought of when I heard that response is that there are many people that are rejecting the whole idea of changing pronouns from what they were brought up to think about and use. And those people tend to be conservative people. And I imagine that if a conservative person listened to GPT's responses like this that they would begin to think of GPT as a woke influenced system. And what that made me think about is that one of the things that may happen, this is just a little prediction, and I verified that to some extent in my mind by asking GPT if the 2020 presidential election in America was stolen. And the response was, you know, very much like, I believe, and I know you believe too, that there's no evidence that it was stolen, and it gave credible explanations of that whole idea. But if someone on the right who believes or endorses the idea that the elections are stolen, I suspect that it's going to increase polarization to some extent, and people will kind of reject the whole system. I'm just telling you what was going on in my mind as I was thinking about that, and why I thought it was important, its use of pronouns.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're touching on is sort of, and we've talked about before, the hyperpolarization of things, you know, and things that were not controversial 10, 20, 50 years ago have all of a sudden become quite controversial. And I feel like that's maybe a little bit of what you're touching on. To me, that's more the cultural context of our sort of hyper-polarized society right now. And also, it does speak to, again, you know, GPT is only as good as the information you put into it. There are people who have taken the OpenAI language model and retrained it on Seinfeld, for instance, and now you have a chat AI that can mimic Seinfeld style comedy, albeit not super well. And then you also have people who do the same thing, but they build it off of 4chan. And now you have a really ugly chat model. You know, what OpenAI, ChatGPT, their model is trying to do is have it sort of as neutral as possible. But again, I think what we're going to see is people taking it both in the good and the bad directions.
This kind of takes us forward a little bit, because we will be talking about what we think are the benefits and risks of this whole idea of these large language models. And you've just alluded to some of them, and increasing polarization. I alluded to that as a possible fallout of this whole idea. But before we get into that conversation, let's talk a little bit about what you and I think about using these large language models, like we've just demonstrated, in some way in critical thinking, the relevancy of AI to critical thinking. Let me start us off. I did a web search for critical thinking, artificial intelligence, implications for critical thinking. And there's a mix of opinions on this, as you can imagine, a mix of ideas. For example, there's a 2019 article in the Open Access Journal called Smart Learning Environments, where the authors Spector and Ma suggested that although teaching critical thinking to young children should be the focus, that AI-assisted learning of critical thinking skills could be valuable support for that focus. And kind of going along with that, Rusandi and co-authors in their 2023 article in the Journal of Public Health, they emphasize, this is a quote, the importance of developing critical thinking skills among students and researchers to effectively use AI and distinguish accurate information from hoaxes and misinformation, end quote. Whereas there's a blog post on a website called Gigster.com, and the author opens the post with the question, as artificial intelligence gets more intelligence, are human beings become dumber? And then answers it by suggesting that it seems like the more we rely on technology to solve problems, the more our problem-solving skills and critical thinking decrease. And that article goes on to say that the rapid adoption of OpenAI's generative AI tool ChatGPT is the latest advancement to make people reevaluate our reliance on technology. And they made the claim that the New York City Department of Education banned ChatGPT on all school devices and networks. Well, being the skeptic and critical thinker I am, I looked at that claim and tried to fact check it and found out that, yes, the New York City Department of Education did ban it and then went back on that and rescinded that ban soon afterwards. But at any rate, those are some opinions about, you know, the influence that these kinds of systems might have on critical thinking. So any thoughts?
Just that the lack of transparency in how the GPT model does actually conduct its critical thinking, I think, is, one thing that we should watch out for. You know, when you and I talk about critical thinking in our radio shows, we talk about specific steps that are taken and processes. And there is a little bit of, a mystery behind the curtain of how GPT comes to some of its conclusions. And that's why I think repeatability is really important and that we continue to kind of think for ourselves. And also to be aware that right now GPT is very agreeable. And the more you push it to have a different opinion, the more likely it is it might make something up along the way.
I thought about that too. And because I always like to cite sources, and I appreciate it when news articles cite sources. So because then as critical thinkers, we can go back to those sources and interpret them the way we feel is important to interpret them. Because anybody who cites a source is going to be making a frame of it and an interpretation of it. So I actually asked GPT, do you give citations for your information? And it responded with a fairly lengthy response, but I'll just read one sentence of it. It says, therefore, I do not have the ability to provide formal citations or quote specific sources, essentially because it's trained on a lot of data from the internet, and it doesn't document the sources of doing that. But I've been exploring that a little bit further with ChatGPT, and I did get it in a couple places to actually cite some sources that I could look up. In terms of thinking about using this to augment your critical thinking, I think it could be valuable, especially when it gets developed to the point, and there are people that are, as I hear in some podcasts, are working on this, to develop a version of large language model like this that does document its sources so that it can actually cite those sources, and a person, rather than just believe what it says, could go back. And it could be a sort of an accumulator for our web searches by feeding us back with sources that are relevant to that topic. So I think in that way, as this develops, it could actually augment our critical thinking. And there's no way I would recommend as just asking it a question and then taking that answer verbatim and use it and saying, I'm critically thinking about this issue.
It's certainly interesting to bounce questions and ideas off of it. I mean, I think we all kind of, maybe some of us more than others, have internal dialogues and debates about ideas and want to see things from different perspectives. And that's hard when it's just yourself. And so I have found conversing with GPT has been an interesting way to explore ideas and perspectives.
Well, previous discussions, we've alluded to some of the benefits and risks of AI. So let's conclude this episode by a discussion, as much time as we have left, to talk about that issue from our various reference point. So, Julia, why don't you start off with that?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think this is the big question. You know, we are, I don't know how else to describe it. We're on a precipice. There's no crystal ball to really tell us what AI is bringing. It's really up to us in a lot of ways. But, you know, this isn't the first time we've had a major technological revolution of sorts. You know, I can't help but think about the printing press. We don't go back and say, oh, well, the printing press never should have happened because it printed Mein Kampf. You know, in and of itself, it's just a machine that, you know, copies what humans put into it. Equally, we have more modern examples of the internet, which was around for actually quite a while before it became kind of a household technology, you know, but the idea that you know, if you ask someone 50 years ago, if you could just kind of pull up a keyboard and ask it a question or search for an item, that it would give you everything that you've asked for was hard to believe not that long ago. So, you know, I kind of tend to have that perspective that this is a tool and where it goes is up to us. The potential benefits, I think, are vast. It can improve our decision making, reduce errors in our research and our decision making, can really like improve our quality of lives when it comes to how we have a very important task of figuring out how to address climate change. And, you know, computer modeling is something that is a great benefit in making really good, solid decisions. Medical diagnoses, improvements in medication, economic modeling. I mean, I could go on and on and on. You know, AI and robots can take risks that humans don't have to take. I think about the Mars rovers and the difficulty we have in giving them instructions because of how long it takes to send that information there. If they can make those decisions on their own, we can gain better information about what's going on Mars. So I, you know, I think that there's a great number of really great things that can come out of these sorts of technologies. Equally, there are risks, you know, and anywhere humans go, boy, we have a habit of muddying things up and you know, kind of creating bad situations. So, I mean, I think some of the risks that we're seeing is, of course, impact on working people, which I don't think is intrinsically wrong. For instance, if we had a UBI, universal income, the loss of labor wouldn't be such a problem. It wouldn't be as much of a concern, but it is right now. Another downside is that it is not very creative. And it isn't good at out-of-the-box thinking, which is part of the reason the writer's strike is still going. Writers want to maintain a writer's room with humans in it, working with AI, whereas greedy corporations, of course, want to do away with all human writers and just replace them with AI because it's cost-effective. And, you know, right now there are humans, as you mentioned, actually, is when it was in the clips, there are humans inputting data and helping train these models. Most of those people are being exploited in that process. They're not being paid living wages. They're not, you know, they're throughout the world and in exploitive situations. And that's something that I think really needs to be addressed ASAP, because, again, those are the folks who are training these models and creating what they will be in the future. So, again, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm all about the advancements in technology. I just think we need to be wary of ourselves and that there are going to be a variety of actors, both well-intended but unprepared, and just straight up bad actors who have no concern for the greater good.
Very well said. I don't have too much to add to that. I would add that it's amazing the kinds of things that are coming out of this now, because people are back in their labs digging into these large language models, tweaking them, and getting them to do their own kinds of tasks. For example, there is a group called the Earth Species Project, and it's predicted that within 12 to 36 months, that group is going to be able to imitate animal communication in high fidelity using AI. Picture being able to tell a whale to dive to avoid ship strikes. I mean, it's amazing the innovation in the health field in regards to protein folding, which is very labor intensive for human beings to do, but AI has been adapted so that it has helped immensely with that, and finding effective drugs and medications is another area that's being used. So in terms of what we do on this program, you know, I think that it could automate our risk-benefit analysis to some extent to help our critical thinking, and it could act as accurate and useful personal tutors. So there's a lot that can be done, but I share with you that how it is used is going to be the problem. And the problem is that people can get these core models that are already built up, and they can adapt them to personal uses that could create disinformation, that could endorse certain political positions and then become bots to spread that meme. So just exactly how they're going to be done. They can also, ChatGPT has learned another language, programming language. So they could be used to program better and better viruses to invade our computers. So there's a lot of nefarious activities that people are worried about, to the extent that a number of people that are working in the area have endorsed and signed open letters saying that we need to be wary and something needs to be done. There needs to be government regulation or some other way of making sure that AI does not fall into the wrong hands. And the first open letter was a long time ago. You probably remember that Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and dozens of others. They were more concerned with kind of the existential risk of long-term AI. But the recent letter that was March 2023 put out by the Future of Life Institute, it's called the Pause Letter because it actually states, we call on all AI labs to immediately pause for at least 6 months the training of AI systems more powerful than GPT-4. And that was signed by a great number of people, including Stuart Russell, who wrote several books on AI, a kind of standard textbook. And then he wrote a book I read, which is called Human Compatible: Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. And other people that signed this, Steve Wozniak, Tristan Harris, and Asa Raskin, two of my heroes, signed it. So there are people that have concerns about it. And my final comment, since we're running short on time, is that what makes generative large language models like ChatGPT so useful, but also so easy to adapt, is for the potential harmful purposes, is that the base GPT model is readily available. It can be quite easily fine-tuned by users to adapt to their desired tasks. So fine-tuning the process really is training a pre-trained model, as we heard, on a new task or data set. And that can bring a lot of great things, but it can also bring some nefarious things that can cause risks to us and problems with us as human beings. Now, I don't believe that we should pause it. This is just my personal opinion. But I believe that we should take steps. Maybe it needs to be licensed in some way, and maybe government needs to regulate it. Okay, any one last minute quick thought on that?
I would just echo that I think a regulatory environment makes sense. You know, when I was in college, a lot of people are really freaked out about mapping the human genome and the implications of that. And that's something that a regulatory environment, really put to bed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've just scratched the surface on this critical topic of artificial intelligence, but it's well worth your time, listeners, to continue with some haste and vigor, I would say, to advance your AI learning curve using your critical thinking skills. So we're going to post many links relating to this episode of Thinking Clearly on our show's Facebook page. And I do want to thank our listeners for listening. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.